From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I am Ben Flanagan. Welcome to another episode of Aspect Radio. We're here to talk about Oscar nominations, and we're going to lead the show off with that today. Later, we'll talk about Kathryn Bigelow's latest film, Zero Dark Thirty, about the manhunt and raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. Exciting stuff, and Corey and I have a lot to say about that. But first, again, let's lead off with these Oscar nominations that just came out last week. Seth MacFarlane and Emma Stone, in rather entertaining fashion, announced the major nominees, and while we predicted for the most part correctly and accurately, there were some major surprises. Folks who should have been locks, whom we thought were locks going into the announcement, were counted out. They were snubbed, as it were. And some seem to suggest that they weren't shocked by this, by some factors that might have hinted at their snubs. But I'm referring mainly to the Best Director category, where Kathryn Bigelow, whose film we'll talk about later, and Ben Affleck, whose film Argo was nominated several times, they were left out of the category. So while you might have seen some of these hints before this, were you pretty shocked?
Yeah, I was very surprised. It's not an unpleasant surprise because I think that, well, it's sort of a refreshingly offbeat original set of nominees from the Academy here. And while I very much enjoyed Argo, and we'll talk about Zero Dark Thirty later in the show, throwing in, you know, a 30-year-old newcomer who made his first film, Beast of the Southern Wild, off of a shoestring budget, Ben Zeitlin, and sort of art house auteur tour favorite Michael Haneke in that category. He's certainly a favorite of mine. You know, kind of hard to complain about those two guys popping up in that race. It is at the expense of filmmakers who I think everybody expected to pop up there, and honestly I think Kathryn Bigelow probably should have been in that category, but it's kind of a more pleasing alternative to me than these races that seem sort of set in stone from, like, October. You know what I mean? Like, it was quite a shock to wake up to, but nevertheless the surprises were pretty interesting.
They were definitely interesting, and even though they are at the expense of deserving directors like Bigelow and Affleck, whose films are easily worthy of those categories in particular, I can't say that I mind that Ben Zeitlin's nominated, because I like his movie overall, and it's something that most people hadn't seen before, and it's the work of what looks to be a visionary in this medium, somebody doing new things visually and just from a narrative standpoint. So it's interesting that this Academy, who's known to be sort of this old fogies club, reached out to this lesser seen movie. Now, this movie was talked about
since throughout January of last
basically
year.
Throughout the entire year. Yeah. But it wasn't really thought of as a major Oscar contender, especially in this category. And to nominate someone, how old is he again?
He's like 30, I think.
Someone as young as Ben Zeitlin in with his debut film, it's definitely interesting. And if there's something we don't usually see come Oscar nomination announcement day, it's surprises. And we got them this time, and can't be disappointed about that. But did you find yourself angry at all at these or any other surprises?
I don't think I was that angry. I mean, we talked, I guess, the day that the nominations were announced, and while I think that Kathryn Bigelow's accomplishment certainly should have garnered her a spot in the Best Director slot for what she did with Zero Dark Thirty, I understand, given the sort of controversies that have swirled around this film of late, why she didn't make it. I mean, that's a possible reason, and that might not be the only reason, but it certainly seems to be a conveniently timed controversy, not saying that it's the result of publicists who wanted to get their people in that race over her, but it's the sort of thing that came out at exactly the right moment to really hurt her chances and chances of the film in other categories. So I understand why she didn't make it in. There are a couple things here and there that I was pretty surprised about. There are two that I was kind of baffled by. Since the Academy apparently loved Beasts of the Southern Wild so much, I don't understand why they didn't nominate its really wonderful score for Best Original Score. And understandably, Paul Thomas Anderson's film The Master is divisive, but I think that anybody with eyes can recognize the feat of cinematography that film presented, shot in 70mm, and it did not receive a nomination in that category, I thought unjustifiably, though that category does have a lot of really good contenders too, so it might just be a byproduct of five nominees just leaving somebody out. It happens every year, it's just one of the things, but those two, I think the two big snubs, I guess you could say.
Well, there's not much on this list that I would say is worth getting angry over. There is one thing in one category, though, that I think deserves special attention. It came at the expense of The Master, in a category that it didn't find itself represented in, and that's original screenplay. Right. And while there are several worthy films in there, almost all, the fact that Flight is up for best screenplay of the year instead of Paul Thomas Anderson's just wildly original screenplay, it makes no sense to me at all. It makes no sense to me that this is nominated for anything outside of possibly Denzel Washington's performance, but least of all screenplay. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you, but that movie is fairly beloved by a shocking number of people, and that plays into it. It's not one of my favorite films of the year by a long shot, and I would have gladly have liked to seen Rian Johnson's screenplay for Looper in that category over Flight. I mean, it looked like that was going to happen, but it didn't, and it's a disappointment, but it's not something that I'd find totally outrageous given the love for that movie in the industry.
Well, regardless of it being beloved, I mean, even if it is, screenplay isn't really the category where you celebrate beloved movies. It's usually performances or even picture, in some cases, like The Blind Side, for instance, which is beloved by mainstream audiences and makes so much money. So you throw it a bone and you nominate something that is so widely adored by the general public and you nominate it for Best Picture as sort of a representation of wider audiences' preference. But screenplay,
I think it comes down to everybody likes a success story, and the screenwriter of Flight, John Gattens, I believe struggled with his own issues of addiction. He's apparently a popular fellow in screenwriter circles in Hollywood. People like him. People like the movie. I mean, sometimes that's all you really need to break in there. And in the case of The Master being a substitute for that film in that category, I think the Academy spoke pretty clearly that while they respected the job that the actors in that film did, they weren't really willing to give pretty much anybody else or in the making of that movie any credit.
That makes sense, though, to me, because the one person who probably would have gotten snubbed in an effort to make a statement on The Master would have been Joaquin Phoenix, this guy who went on this tirade and this rant against the entire institution of not only the Academy, but the idea of awards. And it wasn't Paul Thomas Anderson who did that. It was his actors.
You got to remember, though, actors vote for actors and screenwriters vote for screenwriters. The nominations process for these categories are segmented. So the writers, you know, they vote for their friends. They vote for what they perceive as the best accomplishments, and you know, the screenplay for The Master could have struck some as esoteric, and while actors could have separately responded deeply to the performances by the three leads of The Master, which apparently they did, despite Joaquin Phoenix and his apparently not controversial enough comments from late last year.
And despite not getting a SAG nomination either.
Which is pretty baffling itself, though the membership of SAG is a lot greater than the Academy voters in the acting category. So that indicates perhaps a more niche support for Joaquin Phoenix amongst Academy voters, or at least enough to get him in. Obviously, he's not going to win. The nomination is its own reward, particularly for a film that divisive, and particularly in that category this year.
All I can say is that the guy who wrote Flight also wrote Real Steel, Coach Carter, and Hardball. All films, I would perhaps argue, with better scripts than Flight. Where were their Oscars?
Well,
where were their Oscar nominations would be my question. Here's something interesting, because I don't think we're really all that surprised by the rest of the nominees, except for maybe Jackie Weaver showing up.
That was a surprise.
And the point I want to make about her and the rest of her fellow nominees is mainly about its director and its writer, David O. Russell, who's nominated here for screenplay and best director. Now, this marks seven actors and actresses with Oscar nominations in David O. Russell's past two films.
That's right.
Yeah. With The Fighter, where he coached two Oscar winners.
That's right.
In Christian Bale and Melissa Leo. So you've got to think, David O. Russell gets to cast whomever he wants to from now on.
And apparently he just cast Louis C.K. in his new movie, or his upcoming film, which is exciting. No, I think that you haven't seen Silver Linings Playbook yet, but it is opening in Tuscaloosa on Friday. I think that you're going to probably be kind of stunned when you see Jackie Weaver and her role in that film, because people are sort of lambasting it as not substantive enough to to have gained her an Oscar nomination. I kind of disagree with that. I think she's very good. She's just, you know, a lot more reserved than the other three leads of that film, who are pretty manic and sort of loud, all things considered. But she does a lot of really good work, particularly near the beginning of the film, even if I don't think she gets any great Oscar scene as the film goes on, so to speak. But she's certainly a solid supporting role there. And plus, the supporting actress category this year was fairly weak, and people like Jackie Weaver, so, and people love that film. I mean, this is the first film since Reds, I think, to have gotten four acting nominations in all four categories. You can go back to 2008 with Doubt for another film that got four acting nominations, but you had two in supporting actress there. This has all four categories, actor, actress, supporting actor, and supporting actress. And that's no mean feat to show up there, to show up in picture director, adapted screenplay, and editing. Those are the eight nominations. It means you're kind of in a sweet spot, I think. I don't think that film is going to win necessarily any of the big awards. I think Jennifer Lawrence probably will for Best Actress, but at the same time, you got to be feeling pretty good, and it's right up there in the contenders list.
Once the nominations were announced, you kind of got the vibe that with 12 nominations and with Zero Dark Thirty and Argo being out of the director's race, that Lincoln, at that point, was probably the legitimate front runner to win Best Picture and Best Director. But now you have things like the Golden Globes, even the Broadcast Film Critics Association,
sure,
which,
yes,
on a public platform on television, rewarded Ben Affleck's movie Argo and him as director, as the best director of the year. I mean, he went 2 for 2 with those, and everybody saw it. And so it seems like there's just this newfound public adoration for Argo, especially since Ben Affleck got snubbed in the best director category. So Argo has this new life as a potential spoiler here for the films that were seemingly the new frontrunners. Do you think that it's possible that Argo could win Best Picture, even though he's not nominated for Best Director?
I think Argo started picking up new life when the Zero Dark Thirty controversy began. I think Argo was already gaining a pretty hefty head of steam going into the Oscar nominations, though, of course, Affleck not being nominated for Best Director, you know, startled everybody and sort of put a damper on that. But one thing that I would caution everybody is that Oscar voting this time around was a shorter period of time, that I think it ended before the DGA nominations, before the Golden Globes. None of these things have traditionally been true. So to apply this set of nominees and what could happen with this set of nominees to traditional statistics and to traditional patterns of years past, I think, is a mistake. There's been a lot of talk about how films don't win Best Picture without Best Director nominees. I think Argo has more than a good shot at winning Best Picture. I don't sense passion for Lincoln. I don't sense passion for Life of Pi. Obviously, there is budding passion for Argo. I think that you can also make an argument for Silver Linings Playbook, and with Harvey Weinstein behind that, that's a hard film to dismiss. But honestly, I think that Argo is still the film to beat. It's in the frontrunner position for Best Picture, regardless of Affleck not being in the Best Director category. I think it absolutely can win, and unless there's this groundswell of support for something else, I think it probably will, which would be unprecedented. But again, we're dealing with a year of many unprecedented situations.
It would be the first movie since Driving Miss Daisy, yes, to win Best Picture without having its director nominated for Best Director. That was 1989.
Yes.
But you said that there doesn't seem to be a lot of passion for Lincoln in Life of Pi, which is unusual, because in Lincoln's case, it was widely adored by critics.
Yes.
It has won several critics' prizes. It's got the most nominations in the Oscars. It's grossed $150 million
at
this point.
Don't get me wrong. If Lincoln wins Best Picture, I'm going to be over the moon.
Right.
But you look at these awards that have happened already, and it's like, well, we're going to give the award to Daniel Day-Lewis, and that'll be it for that movie. The movie hasn't even won for its screenplay, which for my money is the best screenplay of the year, hands down, easily. but it just isn't winning these awards that I would expect a front runner for the Best Picture Academy Award to pick up with relative ease. I mean, I think Daniel Day-Lewis is going to win, and I'm not counting it out for Best Picture totally, because anything can happen. We've still got weeks and weeks until the late February ceremony, and of course Steven Spielberg being who he is, it's kind of a hard move. It's kind of hard to count him out. But if you look at Steven Spielberg's filmography, only one of his films has won Best Picture.
Yeah, I don't think it's that hard to count him out, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, he's won Best Director twice, which is great. Any director would be happy with that. And he'll, you know, considering Ben Affleck is not even nominated, you look at that category of five directors, he'll probably win again this year. But I don't know. I mean, just look at the films they didn't reward him for. I mean, he got Best Director for Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan, and Schindler's List won Best Picture. And that is the short history of Steven Spielberg winning big Academy Awards right there.
Yeah, and that should tell you the story about how the Academy feels about him. Because, I mean, look at 1998 when they split director and
right.
picture.
I mean,
when obviously Shakespeare in Love and Harvey Weinstein just took this thing by the throat and established these new ground rules for how these things are won. And Spielberg just doesn't seem like he plays that game quite as well.
Being the most powerful filmmaker in Hollywood and a billionaire will have to be its own reward.
Yeah, someone who can summon a president of the United States to the Golden Globes to introduce your movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. And, you know, you mentioned, again, Life of Pi. And this is a movie that has the second highest nomination total.
11.
It has 11. And it's grossed $400 million worldwide.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's beloved by somebody. People are passionate about it because they're seeing it all over the world. And number two, it's got the second highest total of nominations.
And I think that Life of Pi is going to win a hefty amount of technical awards. I think it's probably, I mean, it's going to win visual effects. That's foregone. I think it's absolutely going to win cinematography and score. I mean, it's in for those easily. And I know that everybody, you know, loves Roger Deakins and everybody loves Skyfall and thinks that Skyfall is wonderful. And I think it's wonderful too. It's wonderful looking. But Life of Pi is going to win cinematography because it is the kind of movie that wins cinematography at the Oscars. And again, Roger Deakins will just have to feel content being the perpetual underdog that everybody thinks should have an Oscar by now and just doesn't until he lenses something next year and the whole process repeats itself.
So you're saying Oscar gives movies gives Oscars to the movies like Life of Pi because they've given them to movies like Avatar in the past?
Yeah.
Where it doesn't really matter how much green screen you use.
Okay. Plus, Life of Pi is gorgeous. I mean, if it wins.
I'm sure it is.
If it wins, it deserves to win. But I mean, this is the Academy that didn't give Roger Deakins an Academy Award for Lensing or Brother Where Art Thou or The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford or No Country for Old Men, which was the same year. So obviously, he couldn't have won for both of them. But I mean, you look at the list of things that he should have won for, it's pretty long.
I think cinematography sometimes surprises you, though. The result, anyway. I've been surprised by some of the winners in the past.
Well, I didn't think Hugo would win last year.
No, Hugo and Avatar kind of caught me off guard.
Yeah.
And even when Pan's Labyrinth won, I was kind of surprised
that
won.
That was the year that everybody thought that the other major cinematographer who is always snubbed, Emmanuel Lubezki, was going to win for Children of Men. He should have. And then Hugo last year beat out Lubezki for The Tree of Life. So, I mean, that category in particular has a history of frustrating me personally. But, I mean, with Avatar, I guess, just being, you know, a bunch of fakeness.
Well, let's just run through what we think will win right now
today.
Best Picture, I'm going to go ahead and stick with Lincoln and say that wins.
I'm going to say Argo today.
Okay. Best Director, I'll say Spielberg wins.
I'll say Spielberg.
Actor is a foregone conclusion. Daniel Day-Lewis will win.
If it's anybody else, that would be quite a shock.
Best Actress, I'm going to say Lawrence, but I think Chastain could sneak up.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Supporting actor.
This
seems
a toss-up.
Yeah, this is about as wide open a category at this level that I've seen in a long time.
Mm.
And while the Golden Globes aren't always indicative of what will happen, I thought Tommy Lee Jones was as much a shoe-in to win that as anybody. But Christoph Waltz wins. I'm starting to think Waltz might win this. But I think Tommy Lee Jones will win for sure.
I have no idea. I think that if there is a wave of fondness for Silver Linings Playbook, Robert De Niro could win. But I guess I'll stick with Jones here as well. It's just like, if they don't like Lincoln that much, or if they don't like it enough to give it Best Picture.
How do they not like it that much? It's got 12 nominations.
Okay, yeah, it's just, I don't know. I'll say Jones, but I'm reluctant to say that because I feel like that's sort of piling up the awards for Lincoln.
Anne Hathaway is about as surefire as Daniel Day-Lewis at this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so she wins.
Yeah.
Original screenplay might be a toss-up as well. Between I think it comes down to Zero Dark Thirty and Django Unchained.
I think Michael Haneke takes it for
No her. Way.
Absolutely.
No way.
In fact, I think that Emmanuel Riva is in the second place spot for Best Actress.
Ahead of Jessica Chastain?
Ahead of Jessica Chastain.
I think LaVenginae Wallace is ahead of her.
No.
Oh, wrong. Yeah. No way.
Yeah, you're straight up wrong.
No,
it's okay.
What?
But Jennifer Lawrence is probably going to win. Emmanuel Riva is second place. And Jessica Chastain, unfortunately, is suffering the effects of that movie and its controversy right now.
No. Catherine Bigelow is suffering the effects of that controversy.
Well, she's already
suffered.
They will continue to punish the film. I don't think the film is going to win a single Oscar.
No. That might be true. I think it could win actress and it could win original screenplay. Amour's not going to win screenplay.
Amour is going to win screenplay.
Okay.
They nominated the film for Best Picture. They nominated it for Best Actor, Actress. They nominated it for Best Director. They're going to give it original screenplay, particularly since there's nothing else that stands out as being exceptional. Tarantino, maybe. Mark Boll, maybe. I think it's Haneke. I really do. I mean, like I said, a lot can happen, but that is a wide-open category, and they have a tendency to reward foreign auteurs in that category. Pedro Almodovar won in 2002 for Talk to Her. That was kind of a shock, but it could happen. I think it will happen.
Yeah, and, you got to feel sorry for Zero Dark Thirty for this reason. Argo is sort of hiding behind all of the hoopla and reaping the benefits of not only the backlash from Ben Affleck not getting a nomination, but also this controversy that has been leveled at Zero Dark Thirty, where you don't have the same level of backlash from people about Catherine Bigelow not getting a nomination
right
when she felt like a lock.
Mostly Affleck. You're right.
Right. And part of me feels like there will be some backlash that mounts. I think the studio can use it to its advantage, where this controversy will at some point have to die down a little bit. And Jessica Chastain could be the makeup call made by the Academy.
I don't think so. I don't think, and we'll talk about this when we talk about the film. I think her performance is terrific. I don't think it's the kind of performance that wins Oscars. I think that Jennifer Lawrence is the most clear example in that category of the sort of performance that wins
Oscars.
It's
showier.
It's showier, exactly. Yeah. But Emmanuel Riva, I mean, just that the story behind Amour and her personal story is pretty compelling as well.
Yeah.
And people love that film, obviously. They love it beyond any expectation that they would.
Adapted screenplay. You thought Lincoln would be a sure thing for this, but I think this could be the consolation prize for Silver Linings Playbook.
I think Argo wins.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. Animated feature. I think Brave wins, but so many of the precursors have ignored Brave in favor of things like mainly Frankenweenie, but also Paranorman, that it has me a little worried that Brave might lose.
I'm going to go with Wreck-It Ralph because it is the, for whatever reason, critically beloved financial success story. Critics love Frankenweenie. It didn't make any money. Critics liked Paranorman. It didn't make any money. Critics were okay with Brave. It made a lot of money. And critics love Wreck-It Ralph, and it made a ton of money. So that's what I'm going with.
Documentary short. I'm just kidding. Yeah. We don't have access.
I don't even know what's
movies.
Nominated there.
That pretty much does it for the major
categories.
Well,
go through like...
Oh, you want to go through like the technical
stuff?
Yeah,
let's go through the technicals.
Okay.
Because I've got some opinions.
Okay. Well, foreign language, Amour seems to be a...
Yeah, Amour's it.
Yeah. Original song, Skyfall, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was like, what's nominated?
It would be kind of funny to see host Seth MacFarlane win an Oscar while he was hosting.
I don't even know what that song is. Yeah.
Are they going to perform the songs this year?
I don't know. No, they haven't said.
Well, if they want Adele up on that stage at least once.
I feel like they'll probably go for that, yeah.
Yeah. Documentary, Searching for Sugar Man.
Let's see. What else is nominated in that
category? Five Broken Cameras, The Gatekeepers, How to Survive a Plague, and The Invisible War.
The only one in that category I've seen is Searching for Sugar Man, and that is pretty tremendous, but I feel like The Gatekeepers is the sort of thing that they will likely reward. But Searching for Sugar Man is awesome.
So cinematography, you have said Life of Pi will win.
I don't see the rewarding Roger Deakins finally for a James Bond movie, no matter how great looking a James Bond movie it is.
They might give James Bond its first Oscar for song anyway, so why not break two records?
Might as well.
I don't see it happening, though. I think you're right about Life of Pi. Editing. I think Argo will probably win this, or Lincoln.
What else is nominated?
Life of Pi, Silver Linings Playbook, and Zero Dark Thirty. Zero Dark Thirty deserves it. But
I think Zero Dark Thirty deserves it, too. I think Argo will win.
Costume design, can we say Anna Karenina?
Anna Karenina, hands down. Yeah. But the designer for Mirror Mirror, this is a posthumous nomination, so there could be some sentiment there.
Oscar nominee, Mirror Mirror, whatever.
It's actually a pretty good movie.
Right.
It is.
Makeup, come on, Hobbit. Get you some.
Yeah. I mean, if Looper were in this category, that would be one thing, but it isn't.
it doesn't say most distracting makeup. It says best makeup.
Okay. Well, that's an opinion. It's not most makeup, which is why Cloud Atlas is not here, even though Cloud Atlas had a great deal of excellent makeup.
Original score, you said Life of Pi?
Life of Pi.
Anna Karenina, Argo, Lincoln, and Skyfall are the other nominees. It seems Life of Pi seems pretty safe.
Yeah, because I don't remember the scores from Argo or Anna Karenina.
Production design. Anna Karenina seems like...
Yeah, I mean, just because that film is so innovative in its presentation.
Yeah.
What else is in that category?
The Hobbit again, Les Mis, which is a possibility, Life of Pi. It had the best green screens of the year, and Lincoln.
Yeah, I mean, Lincoln's a possibility, but that's kind of a bland category. That's a surprisingly bland category.
I think Anna
Karenina is pretty safe, too.
Sound editing, sound mixing.
Actually, if Zero Dark Thirty is nominated in any of those, it could pop up
it's,
here.
It's up for editing.
I think that actually Les Miserables will take whatever it's nominated for in sound mixing and sound editing, just because they shoved the live on set thing down everybody's throat.
Les Mis is up for mixing, not editing.
Well, it'll win mixing, and Zero Dark Thirty probably will get editing.
Visual effects.
Life of Pi.
Okay. The other nominees are Hobbit, Avengers, Prometheus, and Snow White and the Huntsman. I actually think Ted should have been nominated for this. I thought the effects were amazing.
I mean, it was convincing. There was something that struck me as kind of a... Oh, yeah, The Dark Knight Rises should have been in that category.
You have something nice to say about The Dark Knight Rises, Corey?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it didn't get a nomination for anything, and to sort of shut that film out for visual effects and the sound awards seems pretty striking to me. I mean, if anything, that movie is convincing in its special effects and loud, so it certainly should have been recognized for that, for being the most loud. Well, The Dark Knight Rises sound. Is the most sound.
That would be so awesome if that was a category. Mixing. The most sound goes to
most sound.
Oh man, I just don't think the Academy likes Nolan, man. I don't know why.
Really? After giving Inception a picture nomination,
where was his directing nomination?
Yeah, well,
that was almost as big of a surprise as Affleck and Bigelow.
It wasn't that big of a
surprise. It was almost that. Go back. Yeah. Think back to when that happened. You were shocked by that.
I wasn't.
How about editing for Inception?
Oh, well, that was bullshit.
That was a shock. Major shock.
You can bleep that out.
I don't think I will.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that pretty much does it, unless you have anything to say about the shorts.
No, I have nothing to say about the shorts, but, you know, again, anything can happen between now and then. Harvey Weinstein could pull any sort of magic rabbit out of a hat, and Silver Linings Playbook could, in a day, become a front runner, and Bradley Cooper will shock and beat Daniel Day-Lewis, and chaos, essentially. Chaos.
Enough of this Bradley Cooper nonsense, Corey.
I mean, he's awesome in the movie. You'll see. You'll see.
Yeah, right.
He's awesome.
All right, well, that's it. That's what we think about the nominations right now. Could change next week. Probably will.
Michael Haneke might not win original screenplay.
You can just pretty much predict whatever you want right now.
I mean, yeah.
You'll look way better for predicting that now.
That's true.
If it wins.
That is true. So, I'll be able to point back to this and never mind my equivocation. I'll just be like, well, I called it.
Yeah,
so.
You can hedge it later.
Yeah.
You probably will. You'll punk out.
I'll almost certainly punk out. But I don't know. I'm feeling pretty good about that for some reason.
All right. We'll see.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've talked a little bit about this controversy surrounding Catherine Bigelow's latest film, Zero Dark Thirty, which is currently playing nationwide in theaters, and it's doing fairly well. It was number one at the box office this past weekend, making upwards of around $25 million. So it's out there. People are watching it, talking about it, so that's good for the movie, for whatever that's worth. It's probably not going to win Best Picture. It was left out of the Best Directing category. I think it only ended up with 5 nominations total,
yes,
which was a bit of a surprise going into Oscar announcements day. But aside from all that hoopla, let's just talk about the film itself. This is a reteaming of Bigelow and Hurt Locker Oscar-winning screenwriter Mark Bowl, and they set out to make this movie about Osama bin Laden. And while they were making a different version of this story, Osama bin Laden was killed, and that changed their plans, and Bowl had to do more original reporting and rewrite the screenplay. Essentially, it became an entirely new and different film. And thank goodness we got what we got, because I myself am a huge fan of this movie. Corey, you and I wrote reviews that were out there publicly before you and I were able to discuss it with each other, so we kind of know how each other feels about this movie. But all I really wanted was just the same kind of realism and intensity that I got in Hurt Locker applied to this procedural thriller about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and that's exactly what I got and a little bit more. I think that this is honestly an improvement on The Hurt Locker, which is an excellent film, but I think that this is better told, better acted. It's not really corny at all. It is challenging, obviously, and if we want to introduce the controversy into the discussion, it asks a lot of difficult questions of the audience, and just difficult questions in general about torture and methods for fighting the war on terror. And what I love about it is that it's ambiguous about how it feels and about how these filmmakers feel. And they simply show you how it went down, how, according to their sources, this all happened and the United States got the result that it did. It nabbed the bad guy, and it was supposed to make America feel good or feel some sort of solace that retribution was found and taken. But you're left sort of wondering whether or not you feel good about that. And you don't have to answer that right now, obviously. I mean, you can internalize that all you want. I think that's kind of the point. But just tell me what you thought of the movie.
Well, I think the movie's great. I think the controversy is fairly silly, though I do understand where they're coming from. A word towards that, the film purportedly based on firsthand accounts of the decade-long trial toward tracking down Osama bin Laden. The question is whether these coercive interrogation techniques produced actionable intelligence that aided the CIA agents on their quest for Osama bin Laden. And while the person who does give up the first bit of information that the film shows us is sort of leading toward bin Laden was tortured, he does not give up the information during torture. And the film does show him providing counterintelligence and unhelpful information during the coercive interrogation techniques that are used upon him. Now, you know, a lot of people have said, well, just portraying it as leading toward that is enough to show it possibly having some justifiable use. And I think that that's one of the hard questions that the film does raise. Because, like it or not, there was a very recent time in this country where public policy and, you know, the political climate in this country was such that we did believe that, despite all evidence showing that torture and that coercive interrogation techniques more often than not provide counterfactual intelligence. We believed that it was a worthwhile technique, and we used it. And we used it, whether or not we used it on the particular person that gave up information on Osama bin Laden or that eventually led to him. And I'm personally inclined to believe that the political climate is such that nobody would admit, even if that were the case, they'd probably say that, you know, much of what they're saying now, say that we didn't, because majority of the American people seem to thankfully disagree with that technique. But the fact of the matter is, it puts clear-headedly and very vividly and very disturbingly shows what we did and what we as a nation can't really turn away from. And granted, later in the film it shows why we did it, why we even headed down that path in the first place. And, you know, maybe some people in the audience will leave the film fulfilled and thinking that maybe we should have done that. You know, maybe it was justified. Maybe people like me will leave thinking, well, I don't know if it was worth it. I don't know if the toll on this country's sort of moral well-being and soul was worth everything. But that's just, that's one of the things that makes this film so great, is that it very, very profoundly, I think, raises these issues and is not afraid to traffic in ambiguity, and it's not afraid to make its viewers uncomfortable in a lot of ways. But also, it doesn't really hammer that home. It's not the sort of message movie like, say, Steven Spielberg's Munich a film that I like very much that traffics in moral equivalency and in these ambiguities. It presents it very subtly, and it's the sort of thing that just lingers with you because it's not really lingered on in the film.
Or even The Hurt Locker.
Right.
Because that movie starts with a quote where you have text on the screen.
That's true.
Introducing this notion of war being a drug and the main character being addicted to it. This doesn't have that at all. It's much more straightforward. It is told from a fairly journalistic standpoint, even though I think the movie really serves as an entertainment, too.
Well, the film is as single-minded as its protagonist, played by Jessica Chastain. She plays a CIA agent named Maya, who's tasked, or has taken it upon herself, rather, to track down Osama bin Laden, and that's her, you know, that's her goal, and that's all she does. We don't get any backstory about her. We don't get any extraneous sort of character moments with her. All she is about this mission, and that's how the film is. It's very focused, I guess, in its single pursuit of dramatizing this sort of procedural of how Mark Bowle says we did this as a nation, and where our intelligence agency did this, and that's admirable, I think, for a film like this, because I don't want to see the Hollywood version of this story, or the more traditionally Hollywood version of this story that shows like the wife and kids of the Navy SEAL guys or something, you know, back home, or the main CIA agent in charge has some sort of fictionalized personal tie to the September 11th attacks, something like that. I think that by keeping it relatively grounded in a very focused realism, we sort of, as viewers, get in that same mindset, this sort of monomaniacal sort of mindset that, you know, bin Laden becomes the white whale, so to speak, and by the end of the film, and it's no spoiler to say, of course, we get him. How do you feel about that? You know, do you come away with it fulfilled, or do you come away from it, as the really terrific final shot of this movie implies, sort of empty?
The movie really, in any obsession, builds up to this catharsis that you anticipate all throughout the obsession. And once you finally get there, you may or may not be as satisfied with that so-called catharsis as you were with the obsession itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the point, that there's not really any emotional release there. Because how can there be?
Well, and everybody's different. You know, it may have worked for some people and for some of the characters in the movie.
I think that's true.
Yeah, it may not have.
Yeah.
And in some specific cases in the movie. What I really love about this movie is how noncommittal it is. Mm-hmm. Because the best conversation starters, they don't present the opinion.
Right.
They present the facts and let you react to them. And that's what this movie does. It has, in my opinion, no bias. And I like to think of it more about the questions raised at the end of the movie, what you just referenced there, about whether or not it was worth it, or whether or not you feel good about getting bin Laden, as opposed to, well, did we need to torture, and how do we feel about that?
Well, I mean, I think that's a big part of it, though. I mean, you know, you have this supporting role that's more prominent near the beginning of the film than near the end by Jason Clarke as this sort of higher-up CIA agent in charge of the coercive interrogation. And he has this really terrific moment where he tells Maya that he's stepping away from that program. And he seems totally kind of disturbed, but disturbed behind this facade that he's sort of put on himself. He doesn't reveal, I think, that the sort of tortures has worn on him, but he has this sort of macho guy sort of deferral, this line that he uses to sort of defer how he's actually feeling, why he's actually doing what he's doing. And I think that's really revealing while not being terribly revealing. And honestly, I think this film, in the end, maybe I'm ascribing to it my own personal viewpoints, but I actually don't think that this film promotes torture. I think this film is actually very much on the side of not endorsing that technique. It just shows it because that's something we did. It seems like most of the actionable intelligence that's garnered in this mission found through good old-fashioned detective work on the part of the CIA, not waterboarding a guy.
Well, and also people would make the argument that some of the intelligence found from one of the characters who is tortured in the movie is found via conversation and compassion. But in that case, you have the argument of, well, that's just a result of good cop, bad cop.
Okay? Yeah, the compassion wouldn't have worked unless
without the torture.
Yeah,
exactly. Jason Clarke is outstanding in this movie.
Yeah, I think he's really
He's so good. And I feel like this is the first time where he's not just that nameless character actor that we've seen in several movies like Public Enemy Enemies or Lawless or other movies up to this point.
Yeah.
This is the first time where he's actually gotten to show what he can do. And I hope he gets more after this, because this character to me is fascinating. Mm-hmm. For the reasons you mentioned before, this is somebody who is doling out humiliating stuff here on his on these guys who are in custody, in captivity. But he's able to play with these caged monkeys outside of one of the rooms, and he's eating ice cream while he's doing it. And I just think that moment where, he sort of has the this moment that he shares with Maya, where he almost says, "Can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I need to check back. I need to check back into real life.
Yeah.
I need to go see what that feels like again." And I just thought he was great.
But I mean, one of the great things about Maya's character is how little she understands that impulse, which is her driving characteristic. She's like a Terminator here. She has one objective. And that eventually wears on her, I think, but not until late in the film.
Well, this is something that she has endured ever since she was in high school, as she says when she's talking to the head of the CIA, played by James Gandolfini. She says, "I didn't go to college. I worked on this straight out of high school, and I've worked on Bin Laden the entire time for more than 10 years.
Right.
So you see that this is just, it's not a way of life. It is her life. Mm-hmm. This is all she thinks about and breathes. And you said that this isn't necessarily the kind of performance that wins Oscars, but I get this more than I did back in 2007 when, say, Tilda Swinton won for Michael Clayton. Mm-hmm. That didn't feel like a role or a performance that would win an Oscar. There was nothing showy about it whatsoever. Yeah. Nothing showy about it. You can
acknowledge
that.
It walking out of the movie.
Okay.
Kathleen will back me up there. I totally called it on the way walking out of the movie.
Okay. But I get it more so with Chastain, because I do think that there is more of an emotional return for the audience here because of what you see this character sacrifice during this investigation and this obsession. What she, again, endures, what she loses along the way, things that are personal to her, things that she's developed during the investigation.
Well, and then one interesting thing is you don't get a traditional sort of scene of her mourning or sort of...
There's no time.
There's no time, but you do get hints. I don't know if you noticed, but she has a background on her computer screen that is sort of revelatory. It's so quiet and it's so quick, and most people won't notice it. But to me, it is pretty interesting revelation into her character, and I'm not going to spoil that because that would hint at one of the film's great surprises and one that I think that, despite its basis in history, most people will be ignorant of.
This movie, again, when I talk about it as an entertainment, this is just globe-trotting. Thrilling, procedural fun to me, even though it is rooted in brutal realism. I was just enthralled.
It is very enthralling. It is the sort of film that is complicated. It asks you to sort of get used to its jargon and get used to its cinematic language in the first 20 or so minutes. I can see how that would be jarring. I think that cinemagoers who are prepared to do the work, who are prepared to, you know, dial in and focus, are going to be really rewarded, like you and I. If you're going in expecting, I don't know, you know, a Die Hard movie or some sort of shoot 'em up, you'll probably be a little let down. But at the same time, I feel like most people saw The Hurt Locker or have seen it by now on television, and not that they saw it in theaters, of course, and they know what to expect from Kathryn Bigelow and what to expect from this film. So if you're prepared, you're going to find it very, very worthwhile.
And the skill of Bigelow is really demonstrated, and Bowl too, is really demonstrated in the final act of the movie, in the final 40 minutes or so, where you see the SEAL team in action and carrying out this mission. And the skill is reflected in the audience knowing exactly how it's going to go down, and you're still on the edge of your seat, almost as much as you were when Renner is trying to defuse one of these bombs in the Hurt Locker.
I mean, it's white knuckle stuff. It really is. And you know, we mentioned the globe-trotting aspect. This film has a cast of dozens and significant speaking roles, and to have orchestrated a film based on very recent history with a foregone conclusion that nevertheless is entirely gripping like this. I mean, I think this is the directorial achievement of the year. I really do. I think Kathryn Bigelow deserves all the praise in the world for this. Obviously, she's not going to get all the praise in the world, as we've seen, but for my money, this is top-notch stuff. It really is. I mean, it's just that raid at playing out in almost real time, I think, by SEAL Team 6 on the compound in Abbottabad. It's just unbelievable. Filmed with low light cinematography, with the sort of green tint that you, I guess, would expect from night vision goggles.
Handheld camera.
Handheld camera, almost pitch black at points.
Yeah.
It's just stunning.
It's
really stunning.
And you never feel disoriented.
No, I don't think you do. I mean, I think that the geography of the scene is pretty clear. I think that the fact that it remains such, you know, throughout the film, from location to location, from, you know, new speaking role, is just an amazing testament to the skill of this director. And, of course, the screenwriter, you can't count out Mark Bull. I'm not saying that this film has the same number of quotable lines that its characters get as, say, Django Unchained, but the fact that he's able to do the research, do the legwork, get firsthand accounts from so many people involved, presumably, and distill it into a lengthy but nevertheless incredibly clear picture like this, I mean, that's a hell of a job on the screenwriting front.
If there's anything that I might have wanted more of from this movie, which I pretty much love entirely, there's not much to criticize here, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But once they get the go-ahead or the green light to raid the compound, you just sort of jump into it.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to these guys loading up the helicopters and flying to Abbottabad. Now, we know that there was extensive training that went into this mission, and they built a to-scale replica of this place.
I actually didn't know.
Yeah, and I mean they trained and got ready, because when they get there and they carry this thing out, they almost make it look easy.
Yeah.
And that's not just because they're SEALs and they're badasses. We know that, and they're extremely good at their jobs. They made it, I mean, and they made it out with no casualties.
Yeah.
Let's not forget, even though one of the helicopters crashed at the compound, but they make it look extremely easy. And in some ways, it's not as tense because these guys are just in there doing work. So it might have been interesting to see some of that training and see a little more build up from the SEAL's perspective, even though this story is told through the eyes of Maya. So in a way, it's appropriate that we didn't delve too far into that. But if you're willing to sacrifice a bit of Maya's perspective for a good half hour or so, when she sort of checks out of the story completely during this climax, then why not spend a little bit more time with these SEALs, especially when they're played by guys like Chris Pratt, Joel Edgerton, and some of these other guys?
Yeah, Burt Macklin, FBI on the case.
He's great, too.
He's really good, yeah. Yeah, but Joel Edgerton's awesome. I mean, this film has such a stacked cast with folks like Mark Strong, Mark Duplass, Edgar Ramirez, Jennifer Ely.
Kyle Chandler,
yeah. Man, Kyle Chandler. It's awesome. It's an awesome cast.
It is. It's great. And even though, again, it's not a show, it's arguably the ensemble of the year in some ways. Because, I mean, yeah, they don't get the emotional moments like you see in maybe a movie like Silver Linings Playbook, or they don't get to have as much fun with the dialogue and chew as much scenery up as the folks in Django Unchained do. But it's just steely, professionally carried out work here by veteran actors who know what they're doing and know how to handle a script, and know how to handle a script like Mark Bowles here. So,
yeah, almost as good as the ensemble in Lincoln.
Well, the SEALs, they're certainly nominees in my best facial hair category of 2012. Yeah, I didn't even know before this, but apparently Navy SEALs are allowed to grow full beards.
Yep, almost as good as the full beards in Lincoln.
Look, that's the front runner for the facial hair category, the cast of
Lincoln. Well, it kind of has to be, doesn't it?
But there are some other nominees. I have a list of my favorite facial hair from the year.
I think we should share that list on our Best of the Year show.
Okay, well, Zero Dark Thirty is playing nationwide and in Tuscaloosa at the Cobb Hollywood 16 for the time being.
800 million people living in the ruin of the old world. Only one thing fighting for order in the chaos. The men and women of the Hall of Justice.
Peace Trees is the manufacturing base for all the slow-mo in Mega City 1.
You know how often we get a judge up in Peace Trees?
Well, you got one now.
Let's get into a little DVD action here, Corey. Something that I caught up on the last couple of days, which I found to be one of the most badass movies of 2012 that unfortunately hardly anyone talked about, except for you and our friend Ben Stark, who listed it on his top 10 of the year. It's this movie, Dread.
Dread is amazing.
It is.
It's so fun.
It's based on the comic that people are fairly familiar with. I think most people's exposure to it is this abhorrent Sylvester Stallone film, which came out in the 90s, co-starring Rob Schneider.
Yeah.
And
never forget
Armand Assante. Oh, so
I did forget about him.
Yeah. This is a film I saw in the theater.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, and I feel like recently I found the ticket stub for it in like an old desk. And it was, I reminded myself, yeah, I saw Dredd in the theater. I'm one of the, Judge Dredd in the theater. I'm one of those guys. But no, this movie is just beautifully shot. It has some
Anthony
of the most,
Dodd Mantle, man.
Yeah. It has some of the coolest action of the year by far.
Yeah.
A guy who I'm not a huge fan of and I have thought is pretty bad before, Carl Urban, is perfect for this universe.
Mm-hmm.
He's outstanding. Even Olivia Thirlby is good in this.
You're speaking my language all the way here, man.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on. Yeah.
And it's really a shame that nobody saw it, but then nobody saw its Indonesian equivalent, The Raid Redemption.
Well, more people certainly talked about The Raid than they did Dredd.
Probably about the same.
No, The Raid was considered like this just badass action
movie. Well, it was hyped up coming out of film festivals.
Right,
critics,
but Dredd didn't have that.
Dredd had a certain degree of that, but not that much. Not as much as The Raid. But, I mean, they're for being almost the same movie, which is not a bad thing.
Which do you prefer between the two?
Don't make me choose.
You have to. I'll choose. I choose The Raid, personally. While they're equally badass in ways, I just think I prefer the intensity and the unpredictability of The Raid.
I mean, I think I'd choose The Raid, too, but only just. I mean, they're both tops for action films for me from 2012. Yeah.
I think the difference between that and The Raid is, with The Raid, you don't know if that guy's getting out of that building.
Yeah. With Dredd, I mean, everybody has guns, and they're blowing everything up.
So. And it's Dredd.
Yeah.
So
The Raid, it's hand-to-hand and intense.
Machetes.
Not a known property, and just terrific stunt work.
The other movie I have out right now from the Red Box is Tim Burton's Oscar-nominated Frankenweenie.
I'm curious to hear what you think about that.
I'm looking forward. Look, it's been pretty strong animation-wise. You know?
I rewatched it.
Yeah?
I didn't think very much of it in the theaters. I was a little bit kinder toward it on Blu-ray. It's still not by any means my favorite animated film of the year, but it's nicely done. Stop-motion films, I have a soft spot for them. It's just that, you know, I think Tim Burton, he's stuck in a rut. I don't know if he's stuck in a financial rut necessarily because Alice in Wonderland made him so much money, but then after successive box office disappointments and Dark Shadows and Frankenweenie, maybe he'll snap out of it. I don't know. I don't see him snapping out of it ever, though. I think he's going to do his Tim Burton thing till he dies. And why wouldn't he? You know, we have this discussion, I guess, about speaking ill of auteurs for doing their auteur thing. And I want Tim Burton to do his Tim Burton thing. I guess I should clarify that and say I just want him to do something with a good script again, you know? He's only as good as the material he's given. And Lord knows that Alice in Wonderland and Dark Shadows were not it. And Frankenweenie's a step in the right direction, but it didn't really do the trick for me either.
Is it better than Corpse Bride?
Yeah.
Well, that's a start.
Yeah.
Do you like it better than Paranorman?
No.
Okay.
No, my God, no.
My God, no. Is Danny Elfman's score good?
It's his thing, too. It's not really that memorable. It's okay for latter-day Danny Elfman, but again, it's just like, you haven't seen it yet, but I bet you know everything that's going to happen, and you know exactly what it's going to look and sound like.
Probably. It just feels like, from the marketing and just the concept and obviously the fact that he's made this story before in one incarnation, it just feels like Tim Burton's wheelhouse. I guess in the same way, I guess I guess in the same way Dark Shadows probably did to some extent.
Right. Gothic Mansion.
When we first heard about it. But, you know, I look at Catherine O'Hara and Martin Landau and Winona Ryder and even Martin Short
as being in the cast.
That's exciting.
I feel like it's tempered.
It
feels watered down and it feels like the same old, same old.
Well, this is one person who has seen it talking to another person who hasn't and has expectations for it. So I'll let you know later.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear what you think of it. New releases. I really like The Possession on Blu-ray and DVD this week. A nifty Sam Raimi-produced possession thriller that puts an interesting twist on Jewish folklore. It's not going to reinvent the wheel, but as far as horror movies, which were in a pretty dire state in 2012, this is one of the better straight horror movies. Of course, The Cabin in the Woods was my favorite horror film of last year, but that was more of a horror comedy. And if you're looking for solid scares and some spooky moments, which were in short supply, The Possession is actually a pretty good supplier of those. So that's a good one. Jeffrey Dean Morgan is reliable as ever. You know, for completists, Woody Allen released a new movie too.
For completists? Come on, Corey. Okay.
I rewatched it last night.
I see what you're doing there.
It's tedious.
No. It has tedious moments.
I'd say like, three quarters of the film are tedious moments.
No. Like most of Woody Allen's movies, it has tedious moments. I'm saying most of his movies in the past, I'd say 15 years or so.
Yeah, but most of them have not been 75% tedious.
No, it's not. That movie's delightful. And I saw it with the Bama Art House, with a packed house that was ready to lap it up and loved Woody Allen.
Yeah,
and
hadn't seen that's nice.
And hadn't seen much of his stuff, you know, in a while on the big screen. So, obviously, you know, you're playing with a home crowd there. And that works against it in retrospect. But I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought it was hilarious. Just some of his best pure comedy writing in the latter part of his career. I think it's better than stuff like You Want Me to Tall Dark Stranger. I'd take it over Vicky Cristina Barcelona too.
That's insane.
It's not.
Look,
insane.
You don't get any more home crowd than me. I went out and I bought that movie on Blu-ray yesterday to rewatch it because I own all of his other movies and I'm not going to stop buying them with To Rome with Love. So I went out and I bought it and I rewatched it.
Did you take it to replays after that?
No, I'm going to keep it because I mean.
Why don't you just give it here?
Because I'm a crazy person. I own all of his movies.
But why don't you give me that and Cassandra's Dream since you're not going to be doing anything with them?
You want to have the Cassandra's Dream conversation? Because we can go into the Cassandra's Dream conversation.
Well, you talk about a crazy person.
The only time anybody's ever talked about Cassandra's Dream since like February 2008, but we can have that conversation.
You know who will have that conversation? I saw that movie in New York when I went to visit my brother Graham, who lives up there. I'll tell you who else will have that conversation, who was in my theater that night. John freaking McEnroe will have that conversation.
Yeah, I'm sure he came out and was...
He was loving it, dude. You could tell. He was laughing harder than anybody.
He was laughing at Cassandra's Dream. That's not a great sign.
The big twist in it, you could hear him say, "You can't be serious," in the back of the theater. It was pretty awesome.
Okay, well, that is a cool story. I saw it completely by myself. And actually, that's a funny tendency. These Woody Allen movies that I haven't enjoyed very much, Cassandra's Dream and To Rome with Love, which granted on a sliding scale are still pretty decent movies. They're just bad for Woody Allen.
No,
movies.
God, you're out of your mind.
But
I really
but the characteristic here is that I saw both of those in a completely empty theater by myself.
What else would you consider a bad Woody Allen movie? I'm just curious.
Well, those are the two.
Those are the two.
Yeah.
So that means what? You like whatever works, right?
I think it's pretty good.
You're a crazy person. It's time to call.
I'm the crazy person. You're the one who
said
To Rome with Love.
It's time to call.
Better than
call this
Cristina
quits.
Barcelona. That's
to call it quits.
You know, we should do an Allen podcast at some point. Just
yeah.
A theme show.
Do you got five hours on your hands, Andrew?
We'll have to put aside 5 hours.
Have you seen a lot of Woody Allen? Okay, then this is going to be a miserable experience for you.
Yeah, you will be like, God. Didn't they already talk about this one? And no, we will be talking about Cassandra's Dream, which is repetitive in his filmography.
Okay.
That'll be a fun show. I'll rewatch all of them because I own them all. Because I am OCD. Because
you're one of the completists out there.
Well, that's why
for
I went bought To Rome with Love.
For
because
completists.
Even though I don't like it.
Right.
Yeah, I bought it so I can, you know, say that I have them
you
all.
You loser completists out there should pick up this drivel that just hit the show. I did, but.
Yeah, pretty much. That's exactly.
I'm
yeah.
different.
Yeah. I wanted to give it a second shot. I wanted to like it more, and I didn't. I didn't go out and buy Taken 2. God help me.
You're not a Neeson completist?
I'm not a Neeson completist.
The niece?
I'm a Woody Allen completist.
Not a Taken completist?
I'm not a Taken completist.
All two?
Yeah.
Well, I hope that there's like a third one that comes straight to Redbox with like 50 Cent starring in it or something. That'll do it. That's it. That again, like you said, that's another podcast. But we should note that playing next at the Bama Art House Theater is, do you know?
It's The Sessions.
The Sessions, the Oscar-nominated Sessions. Helen Hunt's up for Best Supporting Actress. Yeah. So you can see it for yourself to see if she deserves it, if John Hawkes got snubbed.
Got a review in this week's Tusk coming into newsstands everywhere on Friday.
Well, that'll be Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. at the Bama Theater in downtown
Love
Tuscaloosa.
Love the Bama Art House series.
It's good. It's a solid series.
Did you go see This Must Be the Place?
No, I was out of town most of yesterday.
I couldn't make it either.
Well, I knew you weren't there because you were ranting about Cassandra's Dream
on Facebook
at the same time.
During the screening.
I remember wondering, like, is he doing this on his phone?
Like
during
while that movie's playing? Yeah.
Because you obviously would think, this is more important. I have to see this.
I have to engage with these maniacs right now who love this movie that I don't love.
Well, and like we mentioned before, Silver Linings Playbook starts here on Friday. Hopefully Life of Pi will work its way back to some local theaters because I still haven't seen it. It's up for a bunch of Oscars, even though people aren't passionate about it.
Yeah, funny how that works.
There are some Oscar nominees out there. Lincoln's still in theaters. You can catch that. Zero Dark Thirty, of course.
Django, Les Mis. Les Mis is actually opening on the IMAX screen on Friday, replacing The Hobbit. I found that pretty strange.
Was it shot for IMAX?
No. That would be a very intense experience.
because of those giant faces.
Yeah.
Anne Hathaway's giant grill screaming music at you.
Or just like all sorts of fluids dripping from Hugh Jackman's face. Yeah. Also opening this weekend, Broken City with Mark Wahlberg and Russell Crowe from the director. Well, from Alan Hughes, not his brother, Albert. He's sitting this one out. So just one of the Hughes brothers. Mama, starring Jessica Chastain and the fellow who plays Jaime Lannister in Game of Thrones, produced by Guillermo del Toro. And The Last Stand, which brings Arnold Schwarzenegger back to a leading role in an action film. From the director of I Saw the Devil, which should be interesting, Kim Ji-woon.
We've got a couple of parting shots here from our friends from filmnerds.com, so we'll let them take it away.
Hey guys, it's Ben Stark with Wondermill Films up here in Huntsville. Just wanted to send in a quick parting shot about the film you guys are reviewing today, Zero Dark Thirty. There are a number of things I could praise about the movie, including its great Alexander Desplat score, Mark Boll's fantastic script, Catherine Bigelow's invisible but assured direction, and even its marketing campaign. I gotta say, the trailers were remarkably restrained. Instead of highlighting those things, however, I'd like to say a quick word about the role of Zero Dark Thirty as a movie about America. I think in years to come, this is going to be regarded as the seminal film about our current historical moment. I think it's going to play that role the same way that Apocalypse Now represents the Vietnam War, or the way All the President's Men represents Watergate. Zero Dark Thirty looks at the American ideals of justice, exceptionalism, and vengeance in a way that hasn't been so deftly handled since maybe The Dark Knight, in which Batman is used as a phantom upon which the people of Gotham can load their fears and violations, or Steven Spielberg's Munich, in which a cultural conscience whittles away through years of revenge seeking. Of course, both of those films are much less directly about America than Zero Dark Thirty, but I think that only strengthens its place in the canon of American films. These movies, The Dark Knight, Munich, and Zero Dark Thirty, they take these pulpy American genre tropes of vengeance and justice and follow them to their logical and often tragic end. I really love Zero Dark Thirty, and I look forward to it becoming a new American classic. Thanks for letting me weigh in, guys, and if I can throw in a quick plug, folks can check out the teaser for my new short film, Frankenstein's Master, at wondermillfilms.tumblr.com.
Manti Te'o. Manti Te'o.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Craig in Nashville. Do you hear the sounds of creaking boards and squeaking wheels and rusty springs under great duress? That's the sound of the people hopping on the Argo bandwagon, and if you'll give it a week or two, you'll pass it again. Argo made a huge push for the Best Picture frontrunner this weekend after it won Director and Picture at both the Critics' Choice Awards and the Golden Globe Awards, both of which don't really mean a whole lot in the great big scheme of things, but the fact that he won both in one weekend is getting everyone in a tizzy. However, because of the early announcement of the Oscar nominations, this year is quite unlike any other year. This award season has had more ups and downs than Bradley Cooper's character in Silver Linings Playbook. This award season has had more frontrunners than Jodie Foster has personalities. And there are still 33 days left until the final Oscar ballots are due. A lot can happen between now and then, and this year, more so than any other year in recent memory, anything can happen. So let me give you some advice. Don't go jumping on every bandwagon that chugs along. Just because Argo wins twice in a weekend, there's no need to change your religion. Don't be that Oscar hobo, and don't go all in on Argo just yet.
We hope you visit aspectradio.tumblr.com. Check us out on iTunes. Of course, you can find Corey's work online at tusk205.com. Find me on AL.com and follow us on Twitter at Aspect Radio. And check us out on Facebook. Please like us. We'd appreciate it. And until next week, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.